today I'm here with Peter Cannon, who is the CEO of 24/7. Actually, can you say the name for me?
Yeah, 24/7 customer.
24/7 customer. And this is a Peter runs call centers in a number of different countries. And he was just telling me just before when we were talking that he's got around 6,000 seats around the world. So fair amount of people in call centers. And so we're going to talk today all about call centers and how the industry works and just learn a little bit more about this space. So Peter, welcome. Thank you for joining us. And it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Adrian. Thanks for having me here.
Maybe you can just start out and tell us a little bit about who you are and where you came from before we talk about something.
Sure. Yeah. My personal background is I grew up in India. I'm a chartered accountant by training, but never worked as one. I joined the Tata Consultancy in 1988, right out of finishing my accounting degree. And joined as a programmer, and this was the days when offshore programming was just getting started. I mean, at that time, you know, TCS, as it's popularly known, had less than, 500 employees, and today it's got close to 100,000 employees. So it gave me a chance to kind of understand offshoring, you know, from the ground level perspective, because I was fortunate enough to be at TCS when offshore programming was taking off. By the time I immigrated to the U.S. in 91, TCS had roughly about, a little over 3,000 employees. So it was pretty explosive growth when I was there, and that made quite an impact on me. I came to the U.S., worked for a couple of high-tech companies, and then started my first company in 1995. This was the time the browser had come out, and a lot of internet retail sites were, you know, slowly springing up, my programming background was on customer service systems. You know, I'd built customer service systems for a while, so I thought, what is the impact of the internet on customer service and sales? And that's when I hit on the idea that, you know, in the future, service would be delivered through email and chat, and that would be also a very effective vehicle for converting visitors into buyers. And so I started a company called Business Evolution, and it became one of the leading providers to some of the top online retailers. And in 1999, the company got acquired by a competitor, Kana, for $140 million bucks, which wasn't a lot of money incidentally at that time, because all the deals were in billions of dollars. But it was real cash, so it was a pretty good deal.
So why didn't you just turn to India and move to some little village and live like a king for the rest of your life?
I tried that. I actually tried moving to the Caribbean for a couple of weeks, and then I realized I have to go, you know, just bug people or do something. So I have to start another company. So
where in Caribbean did you move to?
No, I'm just kidding. I just went to Atlanta for a couple of weeks for a holiday. But I thought I was going to take off for a few months. That was a general idea. So we just went with no return ticket. We just went and they're going to stay here. And, you know, and then, you know, I think I got tired paying $10 for a bottle of Evian at the Atlanta. It's probably the foot on the way. You know. So when I was sitting there, I started thinking about what my next venture could be. And this was, you know, December 99. And one of the thoughts was kind of combining the two, you know, earlier experiences I had. One was the offshoring with programming. And between 95 and 99, I had a chance to work with a lot of call center managers, helping them implement chat and email, and they would be very frustrated with finding people to staff. I mean, it was a big issue, and continues to be a big issue in U.S. call centers, where, you know, the attrition rates are pretty high, and finding people who can, you know, write good English for email and chat was a big challenge, right? So at that time, the idea used to run my head, you know, if these people are based in India or some other country where they're educated in English, and where this would be a very attractive employment opportunity as opposed to such an exciting career option in the U.S., it would be a good solution. So in 99 December, I was sitting in the Caribbean, and I said, this could be the next company that I should launch. And so in January, I moved, you know, went to India, spent the next few months there setting up company for some customer in Bangalore, and started off with Alta Vista as our first customer. We started doing their customer service with the email, and then got Shutterfly and a bunch of online companies. And that's how we got started. And today, you know, there were 6,000 people worldwide. There were about 4,000 in India, a little over 1,000 in Philippines, and roughly 1,000 in spread across Central America and China.
You get people in China, like they speak enough English to do it.
No, we're doing all the Asian languages out of China. So we're doing Mandarin, Cantonese, Korean, Japanese, and so it's the languages that serves Southeast Asia.
Can you, like, so the company, so you're working with about 6,000 agents. Can you talk about, like, annual revenue of the company?
Sure. We're doing the run rate right now is a little over $120 million. And growing roughly about 50 to 60% year on year.
So you'll be a $200 million company within 2 to 3 years, would it?
We'll probably do $200 million run rate by within 12 months.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of one of the things that's really interesting then is the lead. So how much of your business is commission sales, and how much of it is customer service type work?
That's right. So that's a good question. What we do is we don't do, what I call a pure play commission sales. What we do is we get a base, amount, and then we obviously get incentive payments. And we are far more focused on web-based sales than pure, what I call outbound telemarketing. So the sales-based revenue for us is roughly about 30 to 40%, but it's all driven through the web or through inbound sales. And the value that we do, Adrian, is, you know, I think the first generation, we used to obviously just put people on seats and, you know, train them well and, you know, provide a very motivating environment where they become very good in, you know, converting leads into sales. The last 4 years, we've moved to setting up a group with staff, with PhDs and statisticians. And what they do is we take off, you know, where Google is. So a good idea is, you know, someone buys a bunch of Google keywords and drives traffic to a website. It's kind of a black box play. What happens from the time, you know, visitor comes to the conversion? I mean, let's say black box, you know, obviously tools like Omniture and a bunch of other tools can track every step the visitor takes on a website. But there is nothing that tells you in real time that, you know, this person is more likely to buy. And more importantly, there's no actionable intelligence available in a real-time basis. So what our group has done is develop mathematical models that can predict that a visitor is likely to buy so that we can intervene in real-time and, you know, in the form of probably a chat invitation or flashing a phone number so that someone can call and then know that this prospect is a very hot lead. And we use the information about what they've seen to make sure, you know, the right offer is made through the chat or through the phone. And that part of our business is one of, you know, a fast-growing business and, you know, accounts for about 30 to 40% of our revenue. So for customers such as, you know, Overstock, we pretty much, you know, do all of their chat-based sales with our agents, you know, based in India.
So, in terms of the clients you get, do you mm-hmm. ever do straight commission-based? I mean, for example, there's a lot of call centers out there that are just running Dish Network. Do you take that sort of stuff up, or will you only work on deals where you have a direct relationship with the company?
We only do direct relationship with the company. The only time we would do with intermediaries where, you know, it's kind of an outright relationship, and there is, you know, a careful recurring revenue model that's in place. That we don't do straight commission based sales at all. We don't do any of that.
And what's the reason why you want to do that?
The reason is, you know, first we have a better degree of control over, you know, the type of work we do, and there's you know, longevity to the relationships we take on, right? And the second reason is obviously, you know, we moved from a model of just putting people on seats to a model of, you know, what is the value we are adding to the entire conversion process. As I said, you know, through the data analytics and so on. And if I have to make that investment, I need to make sure that the revenue is going to stick and be around, right? So, you know, I'd rather go directly to, you know, one of these providers. You know, as I said, you know, we have no problem working with marketing agencies or people who do this for a living as long as they find on clients on a long-term basis and have a predictability. And they add, you know, value in form X and we add value in form Y and keep the end client happy. What the other part we consider quite speculative and it's not a good fit for us.
Meaning that it's unstable if you just have a generic relationship with a company. And
that's right.
I hear Dish Network is making a lot of changes right now, which is affecting a lot of call centers. They're changing
exactly
their
branding
on the kind of sales. Have you worked with that in the past and found problems with it, and that's why you're doing it this way?
No, we've never worked with Dish or, you know, contract like that. It was a very conscious strategic choice at the very beginning. We just said, you know, to the extent possible, let's work directly with clients and, you know, where there are very high-quality intermediaries. We want to work with those that have, you know, long-standing relationship rather than, you know, anyone can bring me a lead and I'll pay them $100 or whatever. That doesn't interest us because we have no clue when the strategy is going to change and what priority we spend in.
And at any time they can change things and you don't have that any control over that. Whereas
it's obviously
much more work, there's a higher barrier to entry to build a trusted relationship with a big company. But if you are able to get in and do that, then you've got a far stronger business long term.
Absolutely.
And would you guess, so would that be why you're at $120 million a day compared to a lot of these other very small call centers that are around the world?
That's correct, because, you know, I think we made the upfront investment in terms of time and commitment to build a solid business. And so, you know, if you look at the carryover, you know, and grow from 120 to 180 or 200 next year, it's because I made the carryover almost 90 to 95% of my revenue. So I'm adding whatever ad sticks, right? In some of the other types of contracts, what happens is you're constantly replacing revenues that you're kind of losing because the mix of business is constantly changing. Now, that could be a strategy for some people, but, you know, the way we have set up our organization is more geared towards, you know, client relationships, account management, you know, delivery of information, critical information on an hourly, daily basis to our clients, which, you know, requires a lot of investment up front, but it's far more sustainable, and we get aligned to their we'll start with their monthly, quarterly, yearly goals, and then their three-year outlook of where their business is going. So we're kind of, you know, lock in step with that, and so the relationship, as you said, there's a bigger barrier to entry for our competition, and therefore it's far more sticky for us.
So you mentioned the high cost getting started. How did you get started? Did you just start a company yourself? Is it privately funded, or did you go out and get that financing?
So it was started by me and the other founder. You know, both of us, as I explained earlier in the conversation, right? We sold the previous company, so we used part of the proceeds to start the company. In 2003, Sequoia Capital became the only outside investor. So they invested you know, a bunch of money, and so the company is now owned by the founders and Sequoia Capital.
Who from Sequoia did the funding?
Mike Moritz.
Really? Oh, okay. So you've done pretty well. So, all right. Let me ask then, why did you bother taking outside money?
So, what attracted specifically Mike to 24/7 and for 24/7 to approach Mike is he was one of the early founding investors in Flextronics, which, as we know today, is a $30 billion largest outsourced manufacturing company, right? So that was one part of it. And two, I always viewed our business as not just pure, call center fulfillment, but more of kind of helping our clients shape their sales and service strategy and play a very critical role in it, right? And so that was very appealing. And we were also very, very targeted on the online world. So as I said, there's very lots of stuff that we do which is complementary to what where Google leaves off and where other intermediaries leave off by providing leads. We are very active in the conversion process and analyzing the data, right? So for him, that seemed pretty logical place, in the chain that he operates in. And for us, it's very valuable to kind of understand the market trends and have someone of his stature on our board advising us.
Yeah, I mean, but some of the guys here listening don't actually know anything about VC. They've kind of just bootstrapped their whole way. Mike Moritz funded Google, and he's pretty much considered the number one VC. And I would say, Sequoia is considered the number one VC firm right now.
Right.
Mike Moritz is the number one VC at Sequoia, so that pretty much put him as the number one guy in the world in venture capital.
That's fair. Nice job. Yeah,
Did you need to take the money from him? Was it more of a strategic thing, like saying, okay, we want this guy as an advisor, and we need them, and so we'll allow him an investment, and that'll help? Or did you actually we've got to get some cash because we are run rates, we're running out of cash?
Right. So the answer is very heavily leaning toward the former. One, I'm a big believer, and this is my second company, and there are lessons from the first company that I've taken to heart, which is kind of did quite well because of the pedigree of its investors, its board, and so on. It has a huge impact because, you kind of surround yourself with a great board and great founding team members. And, pretty much that sets the tone for the quality of people that you attract from then on, right? So if I want to, hire a world-class CFO, I want to hire a world-class COO, just like when I mentioned my partners and you go, wow, you must have done something right or your business should be doing something right for them to be on the board. That's the same logic that happens when I approach someone and say, hey, would you consider joining my company? They're going to ask, who are your customers, who are your board, what's your, business model, and how do you execute, how do you make money? This sort of kind of adds up. So for me, it was more of, I'm driven to make this a world-class company, so how do I get world-class people from all else to, join the cost? So that was the big cost. The money definitely, if I hadn't taken it in 2003, we would have made it somewhere along the line because you see the growth that we've had in the last 7 years. Somewhere capital would have been needed, but this is what we call smart capital in the rally, right? It comes to the smarts, which is as valuable as the money.
This is something I've not understood, and now I want to take this opportunity to ask you, because I've had this similar conversation with others, but not asked this question, which is, okay, so you and your partner sold your previous company to Canna for $150 million. Now, obviously, you walked away with some percentage of that, but it must be fairly sizable. You already put into this a pretty small amount of money, but between the two of you, surely you could have come up with an amount of money, and then you could have got yourself a high-status person on the board of directors or board of advisors, giving them a far smaller amount of the company that they would want to make. Why did you make the decision that you did?
Right. It's a very good question. And, as I said, who you get as an investor is as important as, which business school you go to or whatever as you get started, right? Later in life, it becomes, clearly unimportant, right? Great. I'm going to go and solicit new customers. Chances are not many people go and say, who funded you or, whatever it is, right? Because it's a track record. They're looking at current reality and, kind of betting on it, right? And the analogy holds in the sense, if I came fresh out of business school, the employer has only, my current educational background to assist me on, right? After 5 or 10 years, the fact that I went to Harvard or Stanford has no relevance, but I've not done well professionally, right? And in a similar fashion, when we started the company, when we were in the early stages, the fact that Koya has involved means, it makes a lot more clients and prospective, talent coming to the company far more comfortable.
Why not put in that amount of money itself and get another and then get some really high status guy like somebody else, someone else out there, name any one of them, and give them 1% to be on your board of directors.
Right. But people kind of understand that as well, right? They kind of see that, Sequoia coming in, paying money to be off 24/7, and then you going and hiring a top gun and then putting them on the board. There's a big difference, right? And, so the question is, it's a good question. So the question you're asking me is, hey, is this a financially wise move for, PD personally as the other founders, right? In other words, you're asking, is it worth the dilution that you take on? And the answer is absolutely yes.
By the fact that people take it more seriously because the car actually put money in rather than just someone
who's
on your board of directors.
That's correct. And it's also, someone actually, most people have to do this process, right? You have to go and pitch to someone and make them believe in the cost, right? And prestigious a firm as like Sequoia, the harder it is to go, get selected because, it's kind of, that's why I call it the business school effect, right? The ideas really stand out and, the firm has to believe in the execution capabilities of the team as well as be impressed with what's been accomplished so far, right?
Yeah. Now, we are here to talk about your business, but I want to take advantage of this opportunity one more time, if I may, and ask you, how did you get hold of Mike Moritz from Sequoia? Like, how did that actually start? Like, you're sitting around one day and saying, okay, we want to hire a guy to invest. How did you get through to him?
Right. So, you know, most firms at Valley, I think, Sequoia does accept, you can go and put your business plan on the website, but it does help if you approach them through, someone they know and they've worked with in the past. In this case, it was Ram Sriram, who's, a very prominent angel investor and was one of the founding investors of Google as well. And I've known Ram for several years, and he became, one of the early, founding investors for 24/7. And then, we didn't need the money, but we needed someone like him to be part of the advisory group. I'm a big believer that you need to surround yourself with people with different backgrounds who can advise you from an arm's length distance, because you can take to them, different sets of problems and just get their thoughts. So Ram came on board almost day one, and then he and I talked, and I said, this is a profile of investor who makes sense, and he made the introduction. And it was not just Sequoia, right? It was Kleiner, and it was a bunch of firms, and I think the chemistry with Sequoia and Mike was really strong, and that's how we ended up proceeding. So, but it was not like, I just showed up at one pitch, and the next day he showed up with a check. It was a relationship built over a period of months, and, we didn't need the money urgently, right? So we could kind of wait, and at the right time,
that's a good position to be in.
Exactly, and that's... that always helps.
Very good. Well, congratulations on that. That's very impressive.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So back to the call center. So you talked about you do commission based, but it'll be commission. Mm-hmm. So you'll insist on a base salary for your for your company, and then
that's correct.
Then,
that's correct.
A base of your employees, and then a commission on top of that. Or how does that work?
Right. So it's essentially a base rate plus the upside, and the reason for that is it's not so much that our model is back-to-back where we go to our agents and say, here's your base salary, and we give you the same commission, whatever, right? The reason is we are introducing, this whole layer that we call, the advanced data modeling, right? So we don't believe that, if leads come in and I just use my chance to convert, it's as effective as actually having a basis for figuring out who you should be talking to or who you should be chatting with, right? And that distinction is why we insist on a base, because, we need to fund that and make sure, also the kind of cost of entry is, someone approaches and says, here's kind of how I sell and can help me with stuffing. They don't believe that it's going to be a real business, right? Then, for me, a trade commission is almost like it's very speculative, right? Because you don't believe that you may sell anything. So for us, cover the investments we make, and for us to, ensure that it's sticky, all our contracts are structured as the case, and then, we get a percentage of what we call incremental sales. So it's not just sales, right? So if a normal call center, give them 100 leads and they convert 10, we only take commission on the additional 5 or 10 that we produce, not on the first 10, right? And so there's a lot more value that we pack in. And the way we measure ourselves is, for every dollar you spend with us, how much revenue are you generating, right? So depending on industry, a dollar may result in $10 of revenue or $20 in revenue. And that, real-time measurement and feedback is what makes it very attractive to, our clients.
Okay, so let me ask this then.
If
you're saying a normal call center can convert 10 leads out of 100, and you'll come along and only take commission on the extra 5, how are you generating 50% more sales from everybody else?
So that's where the modeling comes in, right? So let's take a telemarketing example. So in telemarketing, you would kind of produce a file and say, here's 100,000 people who have expressed some interest in the product. Go call them and told them, right? We would have what we call training the model, and in some of these industries, we already have our models, right? So depending on zip code, what is the likelihood that you would buy a product of this nature for $30 versus $20, right? What is the success rate? What times of the day do people pick up their phones? And so it's fairly integrated with about 20 or 30 different variables, which, keeps changing minute by minute, right? So we take the data, train it, and then say, out of this 100,000 leads, I would not even bother calling those 20,000 people, right? It's a waste of time, the probability is so low that I'm going to ignore it, right? And then just concentrate on the higher, probability deals, but spend more time, focusing on them and making sure the stuff is crafted to, satisfy their needs. And so that's how we get our conversion. And on the website, we, take Omniture data and all the other data that we track, and then build a model that just says, hey, this is what they're looking for, this credit card or this appliance or whatever they're looking at, they're really going to buy. What can we do to, influence that there, right?
So you're using predictive modeling, forecasting to figure out where you should be spending your time on your list.
That's correct.
Do you know you're the third business in 2 weeks that has told me this?
That's great, except that you're
actually,
not...
I can tell you the four. I'll give you four. So three other examples. One area where a lot of traffic driven on the internet is a space called CPA Networks. Have you heard of the CPA Networks?
Mm-hmm. No.
It's a commission-based sales for driving traffic. Those guys have a huge amount of fraud going through right now. There's millions and millions of dollars being lost every week on fraud. And so then they're using scorecards, just like you are, to weed out which are bad customers. The
next
example is... Q Interactive, so the they're using scorecarding to figure out where the high quality leads, which are Gosh, no, I can't. And I just talked with them about it yesterday. I can't remember. He was talking about having a team of guys sitting and analyzing. I think it might have been just how much they can pay for leads. I'm not getting it exactly as he defined. I have to go back and look at that, but it's something along those lines. And then the third one is Think Partnership. They have a pay-per-click engine for, they're starting to use scorecarding for cleaning up pay-per-click feeds from Meva and some of these other companies. So Meva and Canoodle traditionally have had very low-quality data feeds. Partners going in and cleaning up those feeds, again, using scorecarding. So that's fascinating. It's interesting that this is coming up over and over and over.
That's right. I think this is the trend of the future. I think, I don't know if you've had a chance to read this book called Super Conscious by Ian Ayers. And essentially, his thesis is every part of decision-making and gives us wide range of decisions, right? From, you know, what ads we see online to public policy decisions where, you know, this kind of scorecarding and advanced data modeling is making a huge impact, right? We finally reached a state, Adrian, where, you know, all the data is actually finally accessible, right? And the cost of computing has gone down, the cost of storage has gone down, right? So you're not at the luxury to just load up everything that you can catch and actually store it before you just let go of this data, right? I mean, you don't care. I mean, you know, there's oodles of storage available. You just store it. And then you have superior computing power and you have, you know, tools like SAS and other things that can go crunch it in, you know, literally within minutes, not, you know, days, right? So we've kind of entered this golden era where we can actually make sense of all this, you know, data that we're collecting, right? And that's why we're seeing this emergence, in my view, right? It's kind of, you know, how globalization...
To do your scorecutting, do you outsource that to someone like FairITAC or do you do it internally?
We do it internally. So that's the, you know, staff of 50, 60 people that I told you is fully staffed with PhDs and statisticians. And they do it. So, and we think that's kind of our sauce, right? So we would outsource that.
Okay, so let's say then you're cutting away the leads that are not likely to convert. But I mean, some people would say, man, you're just throwing away leads. But you're saying that the probability is so low, it is absolutely worth it. And just
That's right. So, and we test the assumptions, Adrian. It's not like you just throw away the 20,000, right? So we would do what we call the, you know, classic A/B testing. So you take 2,000 out of that and call and then show that we do the right party, right? And besides, you know, the companies are free to take that whatever we decided and give it to someone else. And you're not saying we don't use it, right? So it's probably great in the value chain that they can come to us, we, you know, convert at a much higher level and whatever is left and give to someone who does this for paper performance, right?
Okay.
And hopefully it's one of my competitors, right? So we can drive more business even quicker.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so you're going for quality. Now, what does this mean in a call center environment? I mean, how do you handle quality lead differently?
So, you know, the agents are, you know, told very clearly that, you know, here's the probability. So, you know, don't come back with your old metrics where, you know, whatever it is, 12 contacts in an hour, and then I convert, you know, one per hour and so on, should go out of the window. You know, we need a much, much higher level of performance. So they know that, you know, this is not like classic, you know, junk dialing, but they're actually dialing with some mapping behind it. So that definitely helps because they know that, you know, they're going to encounter more prospects who are going to be more interested in buying than, you know, just kind of wait through it looking for a gem, right? So that's what the implication is for, you know, from an agent on the phone talking to people, right?
So are your agents actually trained differently for these leads, or is it a case of the agents over time respond differently and therefore don't get worn out as quickly because the leads are higher and they can then... Do you have the same turnover as other call centers, or is your turnover a lot lower?
No, it's a lot lower. And also, as I said, you know, it's not just the phone. So there's a lot going on in chat, you know. So that means, you know, I'm you know, it's a lot more comfortable chatting rather than, you know, just calling and hanging up, right? So, and that's where the traffic is moving. I mean, we moved one of the major credit card companies from almost a pure telemarketing strategy to that now, you know, almost 90% driving through the web, right? And that's where it's going. I think, you know, there are two schools emerging, right? One, you're generating leads online and then contacting by phones and then converting it, right? That by its very nature, you know, those are people that call me, right? So they're less likely to hang up. And in that, you know, you can add some time to say, you know, yeah, they said call me, but, you know, they probably don't have the money to spend, so it's a waste of time, right? And then you can become far more efficient about it. But what's more interesting is while they're saying call me, you could just put them right there and have them chat with an agent and just close it right there. Why divide it up into two steps, right?
Sure, and I want to talk, I've got a lot of questions for you on the chat side of it, but I just want to finish up on the call side because that's fascinating. So, I mean, what a typical call center turnover an agent, I don't think they last more than 6 to 12 months, and then they burn.
Right.
How long do your sales agent typically last?
Our sales agents last 30 to 18 months, but we put them on a growth track, right? So essentially they have, and that's where the, you know, the non-pure commission model helps us because we have a longevity that we can rely on, right? So a program that we do for, say, Overstock is be going on for 4 years. And so month on month, the agent knows that, you know, his employment is not subject to, like, he suddenly doesn't go from selling A to selling B. He gets good at it and he starts making more money, right? So what we do is the agent has a clear track. So at any point, they decide if they want to become a team lead, they want to, you know, go in operations up and become a manager, there's a defined career path and, you know, education to support them to get there. 3 years, they can actually move into other areas. If they show, you know, an aptitude for data, they can move into, you know, some of the elementary data modeling. And you know, they happen to be math business, then they can keep moving up, right? And then you have the entire, you know, they can become trainers. They can become, you know, more effective in handling quality. So we give them a whole set of options. So they don't see themselves as, you know, someone who comes and makes a bunch of money and leaves. And then, you know, if you add the uncertainty factor of it, we have hundreds of campaigns putting on, then it makes life really frustrating, right? And again, it's,
so you still do have a certain amount of, like, churn and burn in your business, where guys do.
Oh, absolutely,
from,
absolutely. For us, the biggest churn is in the first 9 days, when someone comes in and says, you know what, this is not the job I signed up for, right? Or I really don't like this, and this is not really me. For us, after 90 days, the churn really reduces to, you know, less than 10% annualized, right? So if I take 100, I lose about maybe 20 of them within the first 30 to 60 days, right? But once they cross the 90-day mark, whoever is left, less than 10% of that will leave.
Okay, so you're managing, that's 6,000 agents. What's the total employees?
We have, the metrics are we have 6,200 employees as of today and 6,000 seats. So we're not, you know, fully optimized yet because we keep adding capacity in new regions as we're developing, right?
So you have 200 agents, 200 people that are actually, like, running the company.
It's more than that, right? It's, we are only using probably 5,400 seats or so for the 6,200 employees we have, because a lot of it is sitting empty because you've built it in the last, you know, 90 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we manage growth, because you can't build infrastructure overnight.
Hmm. Okay. And so of those, how many based in the U.S. versus international?
There's zero in the U.S. So, as I said, 4,000 in India and a little over 1,000 in Philippines and, about 1,200 divided between Central America and, you know, China. We have about close to 100 people in Belfast and Northern Ireland.
So zero meaning just you and your partner in the U.S., or is he even in offshore?
No, we have about 25 employees in the U.S., which is, you know, the same team, account management, some of the technology, staff, because we maintain switches and dialers and all that good stuff, right? So that's all sitting here in Redwood City and East Coast, and we have about half a dozen employees in the U.K. Almost a third of our revenues come from the U.K., and about 50% from the U.S., a third in the U.K., and the rest from Australia and Canada.
So how do you manage all those guys? And you've got a very distributed environment. You've got to make sure they all keep performing all the time. I mean, that's got to require a fair amount of staying in touch with everyone. How do you do that?
Right. So we anchor around the client. So they're usually a VP level for all the large ones, which contribute more than 10 million a year for us. And they are the single point of contact for our client, right? They essentially run, from my perspective, they run the P&L. But from the client's perspective, they are responsible for the performance, right, and making sure that they don't really deliver on what we promised. We have a chief operating officer that's a global role, and she's she's American, but now she lives in India, and she basically has all the country heads reporting into her, and underneath the country heads are the VPs who actually run the clients. So that's kind of a fairly simple org structure, which is easy for our clients because we don't have all these matrices running around. You know, each client has their own dedicated team with their HR team, trainers, quality, everything packaged in, so we can hold that unit fully accountable.
All right. I want a couple of questions from my call centers gave me to ask you.
Sure.
Do you buy call centers?
That's not a preferred model, but the answer is yes if it's a new location that I'm looking at. For example, if you're looking at other countries in Central and South America, so that would be very attractive if you find call centers doing really interesting work and it's got a good set of clients.
So
but if I'm not looking to buy anything in India, right? So.
Right. One is 700 seats in the Philippines, then the other has 80 in the Dominican Republic. Are either of those interesting too?
The second one is definitely interesting. The Philippines, we have, is it in Makati or?
In Manila.
So if it's in Makati, that would be interesting, but if it's there,
It's in Manila.
Manila, okay. Then it's definitely an interesting one.
Oh, in Manila is interesting for you?
Yeah. We want to add capacity there, fast, so anything that can help us accelerate, that would be very helpful.
Okay, I can put you in touch with both those guys.
Yeah.
Okay, so then here's some more questions.
When
I run two shifts on outbound sales process, the morning shift seems to get more sales, even though the night shift has more customer contacts. I have heard many reports from other small call centers that it is also very difficult to get more than one productive shift going in a day, and I've also heard that many successful call centers have decided to only work one shift. How do you see it?
That's very interesting. Because a lot of our clients, when they come to us, they all have their, what I call favorite theories, right? Which is along the length of what the question is, some clients come to us and say, okay, I want you to call between 10 and 12, and then 3 and 5, and then 5 and 7, or whatever that number, magic numbers are. And, for us, we guide by data, as I told you, right? So our dialers are loaded based on the rules that are, analytics tell us, not based on, what people think and receive system and so on. So what we find is, we usually end up running it in two splits, within the same day, but it need not be 8-hour shifts.
So you will break it up into two. So one could be a 7-hour shift and one could be a 4-hour shift later.
And it could vary day by day. So, you know, it doesn't have to be uniform, right?
Okay. Next question. Me and my best sales agent seem to produce very well for between 6 and 12 months, after which they more or less burn out and become bored and ineffective rather than seasoned and experienced. Is there a way to save these people, or is it better just to let them go and get someone fresh on the sales floor? And I guess you kind of answer this by saying you put them into lots of different positions within.
That's right. That's right. And I think a lot of them get a lot of joy by teaching other people how to sell. I mean, that's, you know, if they share that character set, then they're very suited to become coaches. They don't even have to become team leads, right? They can take ownership for 3 or 4 other agents of the team and bring their performance up, and they get paid something for that, right? So they're mentally, you know, doing something different than just kind of taking phone calls, right? So you have to constantly, you know, figure out how to keep them engaged and challenged so that there's something new every week and every month.
Right. And then, you know, are there people out there that are successfully cold calling or just bulk dialing, you know, like phone page leads, or are successful call centers only doing the kind of work you're doing?
You know, I'm not too aware of that other side of the industry, so I wouldn't want to, you know, kind of give an answer that I'm not expert on. The general shift for the, you know, more established players like us with, you know, more kind of predictable revenue, long-term relationships kind of thing, right? So I'm not too familiar with the cold calling side of the world.
Yeah, no, I think you made a smart decision on all that. Okay, so you want to talk about chat. Do you want to tell us a little bit how your chat works and why it's good? I mean, the one thing that is out there, which I don't know if it's necessarily a great thing or not, but it's certainly cheap, is chat systems that imply that they're like, call themselves like a virtual chat, where it's basically artificial intelligence that's leading the chat in the beginning and handling the first part and then handing off to a live agent if it becomes complicated. Are you doing that kind of stuff? What do you think of that, and how does what you do on a cost basis compared to it?
Right. So, you know, as I said, we structure the entire chat like a sales program, right? So we measure, you know, for every dollar they spend with us, what are the efficiencies they're getting out of it. So that basically is the question, you know, either whether I use technology or I use people, as long as I'm delivering the service, you know, consistently, our clients are happy, and they don't, you know, it's the same as saying, what if I improve the productivity of my agent, right? And make them buy faster or whatever. I mean, our customers really don't want to get into that because they hold us accountable for sales. In terms of the platform itself, as I said, we work with other companies. So, you know, use most of the popular vendors of their selling chat systems. What we really, where we play in is the mathematical modeling and making sure we understand the sales behavior and conversions, and then, you know, increase that conversion and get paid on an incremental lift, right?
And just to backtrack onto the chat side, if someone's using an automated chat service, which, you know, comes up with, hi, I'm Susan, and, you know, I can help you on certain days, I'm looking for the FAQ, and then it's using artificial intelligence, says, okay, the FAQ is here, here's the link, and, you know, I hope that helps you.
Right.
I mean, that system can handle a million people simultaneously for virtually no cost. Whereas you've got to have people sitting there handling that if you're using people. How I mean, you talk about productivity, but there's a 1,000-to-1 cost difference or a larger
Right. So, you know, that's why I said, you know, for us, the optimal way we introduce the chat is not that, you know, I'm kind of saying that the other system is not effective, right? We'll be happy for clients to have the system to layer ourselves on top of it. You know, we have no issues with that. But the point I'm making is we do not put a chat button on every page. Right? It's not that the client comes and clicks on that and then ask some random questions and then goes off, right? So in the same situation, we target who's likely to buy, and then, you know, they get an invitation to say, hey, if you have any questions at any time, just click here. There's a live agent standing by, right? And most of the time when you look at the questions, those are not the where's my FAQ kind of questions, right? It's real sales assistance where you're using, you know, your persuasion skills to sell. And that's where, you know, I think human beings are really good at. So we haven't, you know, examined the situation where, you know, all these questions are like very simple. Does this come in green or whatever, which, you know, hopefully a web page is smart enough to say that rather than a human being having to read off the web page that builds them, right? So mostly there's more complex questions, more comparison type questions, and as I said, it's targeted.
Anything else you want to tell us about how chat works and like, I mean, why should someone consider that?
I think it's, you know, you made the point that, you know, the trend that you're seeing is, you know, this whole scorecarding, you know, the data modeling, you know, being smart about what to do rather than blindly doing it. I just think it's a trend that's increasingly, you know, becoming, you know, prevalent, not just in selling or online marketing. It's just, you know, becoming part of everything that we do in life. So what we're saying is, you know, you can make your online marketing more effective if you start, you know, building models and doing that, and we come as a service package in a box. So, you know, we make it very easy for, you know, your audience to do this. So that's all I'd look like.
Okay. In general, I mean, so you're talking about this across all stuff. Like, let's say someone's working with a call center somewhere today, that they're, you know, why should they consider switching to you?
I think we'll give you the three saves with lower cost. That's what I'm talking about, right? If they have 100 bodies doing it, maybe we only use 50 to achieve the same saves, or alternatively use 100 to double the saves, right? So kind of what we're delivering for our clients, right?
And so maybe like the way you're working then is you're using intelligent math to drive higher quality sales.
Exactly. The way I put it, suppose you were at Nordstrom and, you know, 1,000 people are walking in. You're not the dumb sales guy who's trying to sell to every guy walking in, right? You kind of, you know, pick the person and you think by, of course, in Nordstrom, they use instinct or they look at your shoes trigger or you can afford what they're trying to buy. But, you know, here we're using all the data that's available to kind of say, you know, yep, this person is very likely to buy what they're doing based on, you know, the hundreds of instances of what others have done, right?
Very cool. Is there anything that we should talk about that we had not?
I think this was pretty comprehensive. I think we covered most of the topics under the sun.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Great. Thanks, Adrian. Thanks for having me.